This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. And you know, you can listen to The Takeaway anytime by subscribing to our podcast. You can find that on our website, thetakeaway.org, or on iTunes. Good hot summer morning.
Wake up! This is Mr. Senior Love Daddy, your voice of choice. Here I am. Am I here? You know it. I have today's forecast for you. Hot!
Yo, it's a long hot summer. Streets are cracking ablaze. Dehydration got heat holders popping off strays.
A number of challenges for Barack Obama this summer. Vacation in Hawaii, perhaps in between Sotomayor confirmation, healthcare reform, Iraq withdrawal, North Korea, Iran, global recession. He might fit it in. Summer recess? Unlikely. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here. It is a hot Wednesday, June 24th, and Obama's long, hot summer is kind of our theme this morning. We're going to also take a look at the behind-the-scenes events in Iran and reactions to the president's news conference from in and outside the Beltway. That and everything you need to know today, including headlines. But joining us now is Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick with a forecast. Todd, what's the temperature for the president looking toward those dog days?
John, there's no doubt that it's warm. How about reforming the $2.3 trillion health system? The economy is still in shambles. Iran might be facing a revolution or something less. Climate change and energy legislation, global warming. They're even going to try to impeach a federal judge in the next couple weeks. Oh, and by the way, there's a Supreme Court nominee that needs to be approved by September 1st.
So getting out on the riding lawnmower more and more is probably not on the agenda.
Probably not. The president's going to be spending a lot of time in the Oval Office rather than on the South Lawn this summer. That's my prediction.
Is this honeymoon over or just your basic to-do list for any chief executive at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue?
It's more than a basic to-do list. It's a pretty darn long one, and that's the president's own making. He wanted a full agenda, and he's made one for himself. There's no question about it.
Thanks, Todd. And we didn't even mention he wants to quit smoking, too, this summer. Stick around. We're going to come back to you in just a moment. But let's get the top headlines. Iran's Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei says the government won't give in to pressure over presidential results. This as Iranian state media reports that the third-place candidate says he's withdrawing his fraud complaints for the good of the country. Today, Washington focuses on health care. Health Secretary Kathleen Sebelius testifies on the Hill later this morning. In economic news, we are watching for new numbers on new home sales and big-ticket manufactured goods. Those may move the market, but Wall Street closed yesterday, basically where it began. The S&P starts trading today at 895. The Dow begins at 8322, and the Nasdaq starts at 1764. From Iran to health care to the Supreme Court, you heard it there from Todd Zwillick, our very own Todd Zwillick. It's going to be a long, hot summer for Barack Obama. We're going to keep you up to date on the issues. But doesn't the president need a soundtrack to help him cool off? Long, hot summer music, kind of our theme this morning as we go over the challenging policy debates that we're going to hear and see all this summer. What's your song for the long, hot Obama summer at 877-8MYTAKE or send us an email, mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
So, good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. And in Washington, inside the Beltway, the president stepped to the microphone yesterday. He spoke about Iran, but he also spoke about something that he took a lot of criticism for all weekend long.
So there's been a lot of talk about, well, a $1 trillion price tag. What I've said is, if we're going to spend that much money, then it's going to be largely funded through reallocating dollars that are already in the healthcare system but aren't being spent well.
The healthcare reform price tag, that's in the public discourse even before the details of the plan. The Congressional Budget Office recently put the price tag at $1.6 trillion. Joining me right now is one of the people who has criticized the plan, but is also deep in negotiations for figuring out what Congress might actually produce as a healthcare reform package. It's Republican Senator Charles Grassley of Iowa that we welcome back to the program. Good morning, Senator.
John, I'm always glad to be on with you.
Well, it's great to have you here, and I hope you say that at the end of this segment, because I've been thinking hard about the criticism over the weekend, and I got a bunch of questions right at the top. But first of all, where does the health care reform negotiations stand at this point? What are your sticking points? What are you arguing about? I want to remind people you're the ranking member of the powerful Senate Finance Committee.
Yeah, and can I also inform the public, as I know you know, John, that there's really two forums in the Senate on health care, some with similar jurisdiction and then each with separate jurisdiction. Like, for instance, in the Finance Committee, we have to raise all the money for it, and we also have jurisdiction over Medicare and Medicaid and some other health care policies. And then the other one is Senator Kennedy's committee, which is now being run by Senator Dodd, the HELP Committee, Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions. And they're actually working on a bill now, but they're working on a bill that is put down by the Democrats that Republicans have a chance to amend, whereas in the Senate Finance Committee, where Senator Baucus and I have a very good bipartisan relationship, we are still trying to put together policy. For instance, we had two meetings yesterday, and I know that I met with six separate senators on my side of the aisle, and Senator Baucus even had a meeting at 6 o'clock last night with several members of his party and people from the White House. So your question is, where are we? I guess the point is that we're in the process of negotiation.
Well, it sounds like you guys are going to have a long, hot summer, too, and I'll ask you about that in a moment. But explain to me, do you have a target number for this plan that you're working on?
Yes, a trillion. Now, we set policy up till last week, or maybe 2 weeks ago, that the Congressional Budget Office, and remember, they're the official budget scorers, and in other words, what something's going to cost. They're nonpartisan, as you know, and they said it was well over $1 trillion. So we have to do what we, two words that we use, dial back some of the policy that we have to fit into about $1 trillion.
Well, Senator, that motivates this question. I mean, your colleague, Lindsey Graham, Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican Senator Lindsey Graham, over the weekend seemed to suggest on one of the interview shows that a $1.6 trillion price tag was somehow a deal breaker, that the whole thing was off the table, that we couldn't even talk about health care if it was going to be that expensive. And I have to say, we've asked him to come on this program. He hasn't come on, but That strikes me as a little disingenuous, considering there are all kinds of things going on in Washington right now that cost way more than $1.6 trillion, and Americans want health care reform. What's that all about?
Yeah. Well, I can't. It's difficult for me to speak for another senator, but let me say that if he were talking about the Senate Finance Committee negotiations, I think it would be wrong for him to say those things. But don't forget what got the bad publicity last week was the fact that the health committee, Senator Kennedy's committee, brought out a bill at 1 6/10 trillion, and I think that's what Lindsey was talking about.
Right, but it is over 10 years. I mean, some people suggest the war in Iraq is going to cost $2 trillion, and we never even discussed that.
But then let me say where he's partly right in regard to that bill, unlike the bill Senator Baucus and I are working on. And don't forget, we're working towards the same end. Eventually, these two bills are going to come together on the Senate floor. But the 1 6/10 trillion that probably deserves some criticism, not because it's not a legitimate part of the process, but our goal is to cover about 50 million people that don't have health insurance and make it affordable for them.
There you go.
And for 1 6/10 trillion dollars, they were only covering 16 million of the people, about one third.
All right,
so they weren't getting the job done at a high price tag. That's what really made that approach laughable.
So, Senator, price tag aside, it sounds like you're saying to me your priority is more to get everyone covered than it is exclusively to keep the bill down.
Well, it's a little bit of both, but our goal, you got to have good policy. Good policy is the best politics. I hope you understand that. A lot of people in Washington think the best politics is a way to get the best policy. I don't believe that.
All right, let me ask you about mandates. Let me ask you about mandates. Do we mandate to get people to full coverage in the United States? Is that part of your argument?
It's part of my argument. Now, a lot of people in my party disagree with that, and there's even some in the Democrats that might disagree with it. But there's two kinds of mandates. One is for an employer to have it. I think that's less popular in both parties than having what we call an individual mandate. Now, if an individual mandate sounds a little bit too anti-freedom, don't forget, if you drive a car in any state in the United States, you got to have car insurance.
Right. I mean, and the federal government mandates all kinds of things. I mean, you have to pay your taxes. That's a mandate as well. Now, the New York Times CBS News poll on this subject, the latest one over the weekend, says that Americans overwhelmingly support substantial, even some might say radical changes to the health care system. And that's even when you factor in some of these costs.
Well,
you sound like you're in a pretty accommodating, roll your sleeves up, working mood on this issue, but I'm wondering, do you see some of your colleagues on either side of the aisle standing in the way of this on more ideological grounds?
Well, out of 40 Republicans, I've never had one of them tell me we didn't need to do something about it. There's a question about how do you go about it. Some people in my party, let's put it this way, start with the positive. Everybody in my party believes that we ought to do something about the 50 million people who don't have health insurance and that it ought to be affordable. We ought to have reform of insurance so that there's not discrimination based upon pre-existing conditions, which even if you could get insurance, you couldn't afford it. So we want accessibility. We want affordability. We want emphasis upon those five or six maladies like obesity and like diabetes that cost 80% of the cost of medicine. We want concentration on that, handle those better.
Do you believe a government program that handles those kinds of things is going to put private insurers out of business, as some in the GOP have suggested?
Well, Lewin, the think tank here in town that studies health care, says you're going to get a crowd out of 120 million people. So if the power of the government, the power to tax is the power to destroy, government's not a fair competitor in anything they want to get involved in. In fact, you're hearing that right now in automobiles because Ford didn't take a bailout and General Motors gets a bailout. So Ford's going to be in trouble because the taxpayers are helping General Motors.
I think I'd rather be working for Ford than General Motors this morning, Senator Grassley. But, finally, if the insurance industry says the plan that comes out of your committee is no good, are you going to stand up to them or do you go back to the drawing board?
Well, I think we're standing up to them already from the standpoint of we're going to – can you imagine the money they're making by discriminating against people because of pre-existing conditions? If we do away with that and if we have a community rating, don't you think we're standing up to them?
Well, I'm sitting in a wheelchair. I'm Mr. Pre-Existing Condition Senator, so I'm glad to hear you say that. Finally, before we go, we've been talking about the long, hot summer for President Barack Obama. How do you think – the Sotomayor confirmation hearings are going to go? Do you, first of all, plan to vote for the nominee for the Supreme Court?
Well, you'll have to ask me that after the week of July the 13th, because that's when we're having a hearing. If I had my mind made up, I would be unfair to the people of this country that expect an unbiased opinion, and I'd be unfair to her if I said I was going to vote against her. So I'm going
all
to
right,
wait
well,
till
make
after
it up
that. But,
right,
but she's going to be approved, I think.
Now you think, right. Now, you're a salt of the earth, Senator, I like to think. The president admitted he's struggling with his cigarette addiction. Any reaction to that? Does it make him more like a man of the people? Or?
Listen, I got a grandson that's a heck of a lot younger than he is and seems to be addicted for only 2 years, and I'm on him to get stopped. And I think he'd really like to stop, but it's a tough one. So I'm not going to blame the president when I see the struggle that my grandson has, but I do hope that both of them overcome it.
Right. Well, we're going to let you go here in a second, but quick yes or no, do you think it's going to be a long, hot summer for you and the president there in Washington?
Listen, it's been a long, hot 6 months because Max Baucus and I have spent more than half of our time working on health care
already. Sounds like a yes. Senator Charles Grassley, Republican of Iowa, ranking member of the Senate Finance Committee. Thanks for joining the Takeaway.
Bye.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
103.5 WTOP Radio.
Warmer tomorrow, but still kind of comfortable. No high humidity. But come Thursday, Friday, even the weekend, that's when we're going to see the classic Washington summer weather pattern, hazy, hot, and humid stuff.
I think it is not too late for the Iranian government to recognize that that there is a peaceful path that will lead to stability and legitimacy and prosperity for the Iranian people. We hope they take it.
Hazy, hot, and humid stuff there in Washington. The president speaking at his news conference yesterday, continuing with our discussion of what the president really has on his to-do list in this potentially long, hot summer. Todd Zwillick, Washington correspondent for The Takeaway, joins us. Also, Julie Mason, White House correspondent for The Washington Examiner. Good morning to both of you.
Hello.
Good morning, John.
So you said at the top, Todd, that it was going to probably be a long, hot summer because, first of all, it's a test of this new administration, and there's an enormous number of issues, really crisis-based issues, Iran being just one of them, on the table right now. I wonder if I could get you to react, Todd and Julie, to what the Senator Grassley said in the last segment. It sounds to me like he's working hard on some sort of compromise on health care, one of the other big issues in this long, hot summer. Todd?
Yeah, he is. And this is one of the parts of the agenda that's not a crisis necessarily. This is a battle of choice. Now, the healthcare system may be in crisis, but it's not going to fail in the next five or six months. We can limp along for another few years. The president wants this because he's post-election. He's popular. He's just come off the 100 days. This is what they call in Washington a big, heavy lift. And they want to get it done while Congress has a mandate, the president has a mandate, and he's popular. So one of the good signs is that somebody as powerful and as important as Grassley among Senate Republicans, where you still need that 60 votes, is playing ball right now with the Democrats. At least they're at the table. At least they're talking. That's not the case in the House. They are not talking at all about health care. Any health care bill we see is going to be a Democratic bill. So that's a good sign, at least on health care. And the one good thing about Grassley and Max Baucus, the chairman of the Finance Committee, is that they've been friends a long time, and they do have the ability to work together in sort of a moderate way. Now, that makes a lot of conservatives angry and a lot of liberals angry at their respective leaders on the Finance Committee. But they do tend to get things done.
Julie?
It's interesting that Obama's been able to convince everyone that health care has to be done. There's no longer an argument over whether to do it. It's now what it's going to look like. And that's a big part of the debate right now. Should they include a public option? And that was one thing that Obama in his press conference yesterday, he really used that forum, that platform, to push hard for the public option and to argue for it. So that's what we're down to now, what it's going to look like.
So a quiet shift there. You're great at noticing these quiet shifts, Julie Mason. And so now there's no longer a debate over whether we do something. We seem like we are going to be doing something. Did you notice a quiet shift on Iran yesterday when the president spoke about Iran really for the first time since he's taken so much criticism over the weekend for not doing enough?
Yeah, it's true. Talk about humidity, you know, trying to see through the humidity on the administration statements about Iran. They've shifted a little bit, but if you're not following it closely every day, it can all sound kind of the same. He came out a little stronger, condemning the violence, not condemning the government, not condemning the election or calling it bogus, but talking about the violence and how heartbreaking it was to see see these sort of young demonstrators, you know, bloodied and killed in the streets of Tehran. At the same time, he's still being very circumspect about it. He had his first interesting decider moment, we're calling it.
Decider moment?
White House. His decider moment. You remember when President Bush declared, I'm the decider.
Oh, yeah.
And it was very similar. It was in the context of being second-guessed by Congress and having other people second-guess his statements and decisions. And President Obama was asked, well, are you responding to the criticism you've gotten from Republicans in Congress who want him to be much tougher on Iran? And they really want him to declare these elections invalid. And he said, only I am president of the United States. And just the way he said it was a very decider moment. A lot of us who had covered Bush all sort of exchanged glances in the briefing room.
Well, he did seem to get a little testy there. And also, there was another moment where he got testy, and that was, you know, beware the question from a reformed smoker. Can you describe that scene for me? That was crazy.
Well, yeah, sure. Earlier this week, he signed a bill, a tobacco regulation bill. And of course, you know, Obama is a smoker. But the question is, how much does he smoke? And he has not wanted to answer those questions at all. He's been very cagey, very dodgy about it. So Margaret Taleb from McClatchy Newspapers, who is a reformed smoker, asked him, she said, you know, she framed it in, you know, I know how tough it is to quit. How much do you smoke?
Do you smoke in front of others or alone?
No, but she
furtively in the corner of the Oval Office, as it were.
She preambled it. She preambled it in this crazy way. She said, I want to ask you a few questions. I'm a reformed smoker. I got a few questions for you. And he said, a few questions? And then she went for it. What were the questions? It was a dramatic moment there.
And he invoked, and the president, you know, talked about his struggle. Look, like all smokers, I struggle. I would consider myself 95% cured, but like anyone in AA, I continue to struggle. When was the last time you heard a president of the United States invoke Al-Anon, Alcoholics Anonymous, or anything else, you know, in the context of his own struggle with addiction? It was an interesting moment to me.
Well, it is a powerful addiction, that's for sure, and him struggling with it. We're asking people on the Takeaway this morning whether they think it's a sort of a chink in his armor or something of a man of the people moment for the president. And, of course, you can weigh in at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org. Now, Todd and Julie, the Sotomayor confirmation hearings didn't even come up, but Senator Jeff Sessions on the Senate floor yesterday was certainly giving a hint of the debate to come mid-July.
Looking at the long association the nominee has with the Puerto Rican Legal Defense and Education Fund, an organization that I have to say is, I believe, clearly outside the mainstream of American approach to matters. This is a group that has taken some very shocking positions with respect to terrorism.
Now, there's some hot rhetoric in this hot, hazy, humid summer. Todd and then Julie?
Laying the groundwork. You know, the president didn't mention Sotomayor in the White House news conference yesterday. He wasn't asked about it, but of course it lingers just around the corner. You heard Senator Grassley in the last segment say July 13th, those hearings start. Sessions was not the only Republican on the floor yesterday. They're sort of at a legislative lull in the Senate right now, and that gave a whole string of senators time to march onto the Senate floor in order and lay down their positions on Sotomayor, none of which were positive. Mm. So you're seeing the GOP side of the Judiciary Committee and other senators laying their rhetorical groundwork. Now, people like Grassley, who's on the Judiciary Committee, don't think that she's going to be defeated. But the question now is, how far will they go in their rhetoric? How far will they go in using rules to slow her down? Will they try to defeat her? You never know if they're going to pull out some arcana from the rules to make things very difficult and take this fight way beyond the long, hot summer that we're talking about and try to make it go to the fall.
And we haven't even mentioned climate change. That's going to take place. It looks like this is a very ambitious, long, hot summer agenda for the administration. Julie and Todd, what would be the soundtrack for a long, hot summer for you, Julie?
Well, Todd likes long, hot summer, but I like hot fun in the summertime because I like a good fight in Congress.
I like the soundtrack to Long Hot Summer, which is one of my favorite films starring Paul Newman and Joanne Woodward. I'm also voting for Rockaway Beach by the Ramones.
All right. Yeah. Julie Mason, White House correspondent for The Washington Examiner, and Todd Zwillick, Washington correspondent for The Takeaway. Thanks to both of you.
Oh, no. For all you need to know, go, go, Todd Zwillick.
And Julie Mason.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
And we begin with some overseas headlines from Femi Okay.
At 28 minutes to the top of the hour. An investigation by our partner, the BBC, into the treatment of prisoners at the Bagram Detention Center in Afghanistan has uncovered allegations of physical and emotional abuse. Here's a little clip of a former Bagram inmate that the BBC interviewed.
For 16 days and 16 nights, I was forced to stand. They wouldn't let me sleep. They only stopped this when my feet were so swollen I couldn't stand.
The Pentagon has issued a statement denying the accusations of abuse. It says that the Department of Defense policy is to treat detainees humanely. In Washington, the focus continues to be on health care. Health and Human Services Secretary Catherine Sebelius testifies before a House committee later this morning. A scheduled meeting between the Middle East envoy George Mitchell and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has been cancelled. An Israeli newspaper says that the US cancelled it in response to Israel's refusal to stop all settlement construction. But Netanyahu's aides say that he cancelled the meeting and wanted Mitchell to meet with Israeli Defense Minister Ehud Barak first. That's a look at some of the stories making headlines this morning.
Thank you, Femi. And we turn our focus now to the situation in Iran.
The United States and the international community have been appalled and outraged by the threats, the beatings, and imprisonments of the last few days. I strongly condemn these unjust actions, and I join with the American people in mourning each and every innocent life that is lost.
Empathy from the president speaking at his news conference yesterday about the situation in Iran, but there's also a bit of a chess game behind the scenes as we try to assess the reaction both in Iran and in the international community to the president's reaction to the events in Iran. Is the rhetoric stronger or weaker? A nation that he has stated as early as the campaign that he actually wants to begin talks with. Bakr Moeen, former head of the BBC Persian service, rejoins us on The Takeaway from London. Bakr Moeen, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Now, let's talk, first of all, about the schedule of reactions that we might expect. This is not a typical situation where you have normal diplomatic channels. How would we begin to gauge reaction to what President Obama said yesterday, either through official channels or less than official channels?
Well, if you look at the message sent by President Obama last time on the anniversary of the Iranian New Year, it took 2 days before the Iranian responded, and the response came through the Supreme Leader himself, who made a speech in Mashhad responding to President Obama, saying that we are expecting action, not words. I expect, again, that the meeting, there was a cabinet meeting this morning in Tehran. After the meeting, the Minister of Intelligence gave a press conference. He didn't say anything specifically about Mr. Obama. I'm expecting that the National Security Council, which is headed by Mr. Ahmadinejad and Ayatollah's representative, would have a meeting. Then they'll advise the Ayatollah. Then they'll hear something from him. Then either comes something from the government or from the spokesperson of the National Security Council. So we need to wait. Iran never responds very quickly on this sort of things before consulting across various interest bodies.
But there's an interesting backstory here. We should remind our listeners, if the Supreme Leader does respond, and as you say, it will happen after these meetings, it would be his first statement to the Iranian people since the speech, which some have said really motivated all the violence through the weekend when he spoke on Friday, correct?
Absolutely. I think it's very important. And since then, I think the protest has been continuing on the rooftops rather than the streets. And it continued on the streets for a number of days in different places, but it's calmed down at the moment. But in rooftops, shouting Allahu Akbar and saying death to dictator and so forth has been continuing. So, And also various bodies within Iran have been trying to find a way out of the whole things. Mr. Mousavi has been invited to talk on television or to be interviewed or sit opposite someone from Ahmadinejad's side, and he has refused. He said, I only come if you give me time. to talk and express myself exactly as I want to the Iranian nation. So there are attempts to find a way out. You may have heard that the fourth candidate, Mr. Rezaei, who is the former Revolutionary Guard commander, has withdrawn his protest, saying that to calm down the situation, I've decided to forget about my own rights. And the
he came in, if I may, we've been reporting this morning, his name is Mohsen Razi.
Mohsen Rezaei,
and he's a former Iranian Revolutionary Guard leader, and he came in third, I believe. Is that right?
Correct. He came third. And he has got a website. One of his websites today had some reaction to Mr. Obama. It wasn't very clear. He said it was an interference in Iranian affairs, but at the same time said Mr. Obama has been under enormous pressure from Mr. McCain and others to say something, and they trying to say we understand the predicament that Mr. Obama is in, and also some of the users of the website saying that Mr. Obama said the right thing. We have to appreciate that one. Others were saying, no, he's the same as others and so forth. So it was good debate about Mr. Obama's speech, although it wasn't reported fully by the Iranian media.
Right. You know, let me throw a theory at you, Bakr Moeen, and you're actually the perfect person to ask here. It seems to me that a lot of statements that have been coming out of official channels in Tehran have been really stridently critical of the British government, as though the British have suddenly become the great Satan over there. Is this a bit of a ploy by focusing on Britain? It is a way to both be critical of outside coverage and outside criticism, but it's a sign of restraint on criticism of the U.S. government.
You are absolutely right. Britain has had long history with Iran. Britain has interfered in Iranian affairs in 19th century and early 20th century, and Britain is seen to have been behind the overthrow of Prime Minister Mossadegh, or at least one of them, with the help of the Americans. But it's more recently, there are two reasons. Number one, the Iranians think that Britain is far more hardline on the Iranian nuclear program. And number two is the BBC Persian television that has started some 6 months ago and has become the focus of attention for the Iranians, as BBC radio was during the Iranian Revolution.
Well, that's very interesting. Finally, there have been some in analysis reports and even people inside Iran suggesting that Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme leader, has been politically compromised by everything that's taken place since the election, and that there will be some move to either replace him or to force him to share power. Do you think he's politically compromised, or does this blow over?
Well, he has been undermined by being too much associated with Mr. Ahmadinejad. He would be seen in Mr. Ahmadinejad's failures. I don't think at the moment there is a move to replace him or anything, nor the opposition is in a position. I think we'll see a continuation of what has been until another opportunity, I suppose, if there is a major upheaval in the country.
Bakr Moeen, former head of the BBC Persian service, speaking with us from London about the events in Iran and the signs of Obama's reaction. And some late news on the economy, which will probably move the market. Durable goods orders up sharply in the U.S. for the second straight month in May. Big gains in aircraft, the reason.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. More than 50 people are dead in Pakistan after a missile strike by U.S. drone aircraft in a Taliban stronghold area. Joining us for more on this, as events in Iran tend to shield us and shadow other important stories in the region, is the BBC's Rob Watson, who joins us from London. Good morning, Rob.
Morning, John.
What do you make of this? I mean, I heard as recently as, I believe, yesterday that the new general in Afghanistan was restricting the use of airstrikes to protect civilians.
Well, this is quite a different thing. This is about, he's talking about, General McChrystal is talking about not so many the use of air power. in Afghanistan because they're so worried about civilian casualties. This is just over the border, and one should stress it is only just over the border in South Waziristan, and this involves these unmanned aerial aircraft, the drones, firing missiles intended to target militant leaders.
Now, would the order of the rules of engagement here be that the CIA is working with Pakistani troops? Because, of course, both have an interest in rolling back the Taliban, and there's been talk all week long that a final offensive is about to commence.
Well, that, of course, is the big issue and the big talking point right now. I think what most analysts believe is that clearly there is closer cooperation at this point in time between the CIA, which operates the drones, and Pakistani security establishment. Now, well, why do we think that? Well, for a start, we know that the Pakistanis are preparing their own military offensive in South Waziristan, which is supposed to be pretty much HQ of the Pakistani, Afghan, Taliban, and Al-Qaeda. And so this is perhaps these missile strikes as a bit of a softening up in advance of that offensive. And if you just look at the pattern of the last few weeks, there really does seem to be an intensification of the missile strikes in that part of Pakistan.
And it's not simply in the air that you can detect that pattern. On the ground, we had a report this week that a major tribal rival or critic or enemy of Batula Masood, who, of course, is the Taliban leader that is the object of this offensive by Pakistan, was gunned down. Is this a sign that the Taliban is pushing back, that there's a lot of sort of street fighting going on here?
Very much so. I guess if you were going to do a sort of scorecard, that was definitely a bad one for the Pakistani establishment. And it sort of highlights a big problem that Pakistan is going to have in this offensive in South Waziristan. The first problem is that unlike the Swat Valley, where they've been active in the last few weeks, essentially South Waziristan has been under Taliban or militant control for the last decade, so it's going to be difficult. The other problem is Pakistan, the Pakistani state, doesn't have that many reliable friends in the tribal complex of South Waziristan.
Right.
And one of the friends that it thought that it did have, as you say, was shot earlier in the week, and we think it is by someone loyal to Baitullah Masood, who is the Pakistan's number one enemy, public enemy number one.
Well, finally, Rob, we've been taking a kind of an analytical track here, but 50 people are believed dead in Pakistan after this missile strike. Any sense of the casualties, civilian involvement, that sort of thing?
No. The details are always super murky. The CIA doesn't talk about it. It's too dangerous for reporters to get that. All we can say is that the intended targets were clearly allies of Baitullah Masood.
Well, attempting to discern from the pattern of events in Pakistan what's going on, as, again, we have reports that a major offensive against the Taliban strongholds in Waziristan is about to commence from Pakistani authorities. 50 people dead in Pakistan after a missile strike believed to be from a U.S. drone aircraft. BBC's Rob Watson bringing us up to date.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, soliciting opinions about schools that offer students cash rewards for improved grades and attendance records. Is it ethical? Is it bribery? Viewpoints now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
So I want to get a nominee to the Supreme Court and deal with Iran and quit smoking this summer. That's on Barack Obama's to-do list, but he needs a soundtrack to cool off his long, hot summer.
My name's Phil Doze from Wilton, North Dakota. The song that I think should be on President Obama's playlist is Hot Town Summer in the City by the Lovin' Spoonful.
Hot Town Summer in the City, back of my neck getting dirty and gritty. Bend down, isn't it a pity? Doesn't seem to be a shadow in the city.
An alternative to dirty and gritty, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or send us an email, mytake@thetakeaway.org. Femi Oke has our headline playlist for this morning.
Hello there, 12 minutes to the top of the hour. We have some fresh economic numbers out this hour. Big ticket manufacturing orders, so-called durable goods, are up for the second straight month. The jump is at 1.8%. That's a lot better than forecasters actually expected. And that number includes things like computers and appliances. Economists watch it very closely because it has a large ripple effect across the economy. So the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development say that a weak and fragile recovery in the global economy is likely to begin soon. In its largest economic report, the OECD says the world economy will continue to decline through 2009, but the lowest point appears to be approaching. The Pentagon's newest force takes on the enemy with keyboards. Today, the U.S. military launches CyberCom. It's a new group commanding all forces defending Pentagon networks and attacking enemy systems. The Obama administration is increasing attention to digital security. Now, a few weeks ago, President Obama rolled out a plan for a separate civilian cybersecurity office run out of the White House. There are reports this morning that the U.S. will send an ambassador to Syria. This would be a big shift from current policy, since there hasn't been an ambassador to Syria in 4 years. The expected move is seen as a sign that the Obama administration sees Syria as able to play a role in helping the White House achieve its goals in the Middle East. Apple boss Steve Jobs appears to be close to returning to work. A doctor gives him an excellent prognosis following a liver transplant, and Jobs has been on medical leave since January, and rumours about his health have swelled since, sometimes rocking Apple's stock. And finally, in a news conference yesterday, a reformed smoker put the president on the spot and asked him about his smoking habit.
I would say that I am 95% cured, but there are times where I mess up. And I mean, I've said this before. I get this question about once every month or so.
So Margaret Talev of McClatchy Newspapers fired off the questions yesterday. How many cigarettes a day do you smoke? Do you smoke alone or in the presence of other people, making the president squirm a little bit?
Yeah, she's going to get a private lunch in the Oval Office pretty soon, don't you think? Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
So joining us now for more reaction to both the admission of smoking and other revelations from the news conference yesterday is Joshua Johnson, reporter and anchor with WLRN, Miami Herald News from Miami. Also, our friend of the program, Jerome Vaughn, news director of WDET in Detroit, where the takeaway is heard. Wanted to bring you both in to get an outside the Beltway reaction to President Obama speaking on health care, on Iran, situation with financial regulations. Joshua Johnson, let me start with you. What are your listeners' reactions on what the president rolled out at his news conference? I mean, we're thinking it's going to be a long, hot summer for the president at this point.
Yeah, you know, considering that it's 98 degrees in Miami right now, I don't appreciate that Bananarama song. There's nothing cool about the summer in Miami,
so
you know.
Okay.
It's hot and wet.
Thank you.
But in terms of Iran, right?
In any sort of reaction. I mean, you guys are taking the pulse of your various communities, and there was a lot to react to down there, and I wonder what you're hearing.
Well, in terms of Iran, I can start there. South Florida's Iranian community isn't necessarily huge, and it's not necessarily as unified as you might see in other places, which is kind of an offshoot of life in Miami. I guess I've kind of learned from being here that it's very dangerous to treat any group as a monolith. So when it comes to Cubans and Fidel Castro, every Cuban has a different perspective on how to deal with the Castro regime.
Right.
When it comes to Venezuelans and Hugo Chavez, everyone has a different perspective. So when it comes to Mousavi, there are some people who have said, yeah, he's the guy, and then there are others who kind of view him as a John Kerry, kind of a better than the current administration alternative. Like, they would rather have total reform in Iran, but if Mousavi is the first step towards that reform, then okay, fine.
Well, you actually sent one of your reporters to gauge reaction in your community. And here's a comment from Abdi Javodzadeh, who is a professor at Florida International University, which spends a lot of time talking about Middle East issues. Here's what the professor had to say.
It was a sign that there is still some kind of a collective behavior and collective thinking among Iranians, or at least South Florida. I've heard of other cities like New York and Washington and Los Angeles and other cities that Iranians have been able to come together over the same issue. So that's the exciting part.
I mean, we're certainly seeing that here in New York, Joshua. Are Iranians coming together over at least the coverage of what's going on there?
Well, they're coming. I'm not sure exactly how much it's gotten people's attention within the Iranian community, certainly. Outside, not so much. But
right.
Yeah, there's been a lot of talk. There have been a lot of rallies and political conversations. FIU just held an event last Saturday for people to discuss it and debate everything over whether Iran should keep its current flag or go back to the old flag. So
that's
definitely gotten attention.
That's
interesting. It's definitely gotten attention.
The Middle East is always an issue there in Detroit, Jerome Vaughn. What are your listeners saying?
Well, primarily, they're waiting to see what's going on. I mean, the Iranian community is not all that large here. There were a few rallies. There was one up in Lansing with about 50 people a few days ago. There have been a few here in Metro Detroit. But overall, I think really people want to see how this is going to play out. We've had a number of people on that have talked to, you know, folks back home in Iran and, you know, talk about their concerns and business connections. And those are really the main concerns of people here, are family members back home and how business concerns might be hit. But it hasn't grown to this huge level here in the area that you think it might.
Well, in Detroit, of course, there are a number of things on the long, hot summer agenda there that would be of concern to your listeners, Jerome. I mean, forget the auto industry for a moment. Was there any reaction to the discussion of health care on this program? Senator Grassley, just about an hour ago, seemed to suggest that there's going to actually be a plan.
Healthcare is important. I mean, it's something that people think about, but, you know, by and large, it is overwhelmed here by the job situation, and that's really the focus effort of everyone. Healthcare plays into that. If you've got a job, you're more likely to have some healthcare. People are worried about, well, when I lose my job, or if I lose my job, what am I going to do? How are my kids going to get to the doctor? How am I going to get to the doctor? And so that's mainly where the healthcare discussion here is here in Detroit. With large numbers of unemployed and a high poverty level, there's also worry about, you know, people below the poverty line and how they're going to get taken care of under any new system.
What do you think people's reaction is going to be, Joshua, to this idea that aside from everything else he has to deal with, the president is struggling mightily with a nicotine addiction?
Well, depending on who you ask, the fact that you can smoke in some places in South Florida and can't in others is either the best thing about living here or the worst thing about living here, because we're a nightlife community. So some people like to go out and smoke, and some people hate to go out and be around smokers like me. So it's depending on who you ask, it's either going to be really popular or, you know, why doesn't he just kick the habit and stop smoking already?
I used to
work in tobacco prevention years ago, like
11
years ago. So, yeah, Florida, if you've ever seen the Truth campaign on TV, those crazy ads where they lay down in front of the tobacco, Florida originated that campaign, and I used to be in the ads. So for me, looking at this, especially in a state like Florida that has been wildly successful in getting young people not to smoke, there are lots and lots of people in the state of Florida who are saying, thank goodness he's doing this, and being kind of public about
open
it.
About it, yeah. Mark Steiner hosted the Mark Steiner Show on WEAA in Baltimore, Maryland. Mark, you know, I have this image of Barack Obama sneaking out of the White House and going over to the Jefferson Memorial to have a cigarette. What do you think?
Well, you know, that's probably what he does. He's saying, can I have a hit on this? Could you have another one? Can I have one? I could. If you're in the White House, I think, and you are a smoker, that's one way to get into the Oval Office, maybe.
Are your listeners reacting to this sort of thing?
They were not so much. They were acting more about Iran and health care than they were about smoking, I think.
What did they say about health care before we go?
But very quickly, it's a state that's got a lot of single-payer activity and a lot of health care for all activity. It's been a boiling issue here between inside the progressive community, especially, one side and the other. So it's been a hot topic on our airwaves.
All right. Well, Mark Steiner, thanks for being with us. Host of the Mark Steiner Show on WEAA in Baltimore, Maryland, where the takeaway is heard. Also, Jerome Vaughn, news director at WDET in Detroit. And Joshua Johnson, reporter and anchor with WLRN Miami Herald News. Thanks to all of you.
Anytime.
And there's some reaction from far outside the Beltway. With all these issues on his plate for the long, hot summer, what should be on Barack Obama's soundtrack to cool him off? 877-8-MY-TAKE or send an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. And we've got our eye on health care reform, just like the president. Here's your takeaway.
One of the good signs is that somebody as powerful and as important as Grassley among Senate Republicans, where you still need that 60 votes, is playing ball right now with the Democrats. At least they're at the table. At least they're talking. That's not the case in the House.
Our man on the Hill, Todd Zwillick, talking about Senator Charles Grassley, who we talked with on the program, podcasted at iTunes or thetakeaway.org. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
The President's Cigarette Threat.
Have I fallen off the wagon sometimes? Yes.
Get down! Get down! Get down!
The, am I a daily smoker, a constant smoker? No. I don't do it in front of my kids. I don't do it in front of my family.
Security room, follow up. What the hell's going on?
And, you know, I would say that I am 95% cured, but there are times where, I mess up.
Not clear. False alarm.
Travel secure.
The president admits he's still smoking and wrestles with his nicotine addiction. The Secret Service can't help him with this threat. What does it mean for the most powerful leader on earth? Chink in the armor or man of the people? We're all secure here on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. Wednesday, June 24th. I don't know. I think it's a huge deal. The president admits he still smokes. Were you surprised? All you reform smokers out there, what do you think? 877-8-MY-TAKE. Also, how high is the bar for Iraqis going it alone as the U.S. troops withdraw? The Darth Vader of baseball, a conversation on that. Any guesses who that is? Healthcare, German potato salad style, and the woman who invented Obama's consumer approach to bank regulations. All that and everything you need to know this morning, including headlines. But first, joining us now, a friend of The Takeaway, overlord to all our listeners in Detroit, Jerome Vaughn of station WDET. Jerome, good morning.
Good morning, John.
President says he's wrestling with his nicotine addiction. Are your listeners saying chink in the armor or man of the people?
Definitely man of the people. People here in Detroit smoke. It's a big deal. We've got three casinos. When you pass by one of them, the doors open. You can see the cloud of smoke tumble onto the street. So definitely man of the people.
All right. Now, here's the question. Does him struggling with this in the open now make him more likely to have an impact on smokers? Or do they just say, ah, he's one of us, I'm going to smoke more?
I think they're going to think about it a little more. I think the other thing that's really interesting, I think he's going to have an impact on young people. Most of the people I know who smoke are in their mid-20s, and so they may be thinking about it a little more because of him talking about his problem.
Well, Barack Obama is all about macho these days. I guess smoking macho is perhaps going to be replaced with trying to quit macho, huh?
Well, yeah. You know, so it's the sensitive side of the president as well.
And the sensitive side of Detroit. Jerome Vaughn from member station WDET. Thanks, Jerome.
Good to be with you.
Quickly in the headlines, fresh economic news just out last hour. It's good news. Big ticket manufacturing orders were way above what leading forecasters thought they would be, a full 1.8% jump in a month. That number could move the markets, and it looks like a positive opening when Wall Street opens later on this hour. Later this morning, we're going to get fresh numbers on new home sales. And the wife of Iran's top opposition presidential candidate says Iran is now under martial law, referring to the government crackdown on protesters. The market begins where it started yesterday. The S&P starts trading at 895. It's an ambitious summer for the president. Quitting smoking, dealing with the Supreme Court, Iran, health care reform. A long, hot summer. The president needs a soundtrack to help cool him off. What's your song for a long, hot summer? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here. You know, I don't care what you think. We've been talking about all the issues that Barack Obama talked about yesterday, but it seems to me that almost nothing he said yesterday about health care, about Iran, is bigger than this.
Look, I've said before that as a former smoker, I constantly struggle with it. Have I fallen off the wagon sometimes? Yes. Am I a daily smoker, a constant smoker? No. I don't do it in front of my kids. I don't do it in front of my family. And, you know, I would say that I am 95% cured, but there are times where There are times where I mess up.
95% cured. Is that like 5% pregnant? I have so many questions about this. For instance, who in the White House gets him the cigarettes, all right? Is it like the Secret Service guy? Is it somebody in the kitchen? I mean, Michelle Obama said during the campaign that she told him to quit smoking. If Michelle Obama told me to quit smoking, I'm not even married to her, I would stop smoking, okay? So he's in a very dangerous game here. Who's reacting to this?
I think the press is making a big deal out of the president's smoking problem. It is a problem. He is addressing it. He's trying to take care of it. I think we should leave him alone. He has many other problems around the world, dealing with the economy, dealing with foreign policy. The list is endless.
Well, our listeners are right about that. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. But that may be the stress of dealing with all those issues may actually be partly why he's having so much trouble quitting smoking. Joining us to talk more about the president smoking and the potential for the bully pulpit being a real teachable moment for healthcare professionals around the United States is Richard Hurt, who's director of the Mayo Clinic Nicotine Dependence Center. Good morning, Richard Hurt.
Good morning.
Are you a doctor, by the way?
I am.
All right. Dr. Hurt, thanks for being with us. First of all, you know, people are going to rag on me for making more of this, but it seems to me it is a moment where suddenly the significance and severity of nicotine addiction takes center stage. And I'm wondering what kind of an opportunity you think this is for you.
Well, I think it just underscores how difficult this is for some people. Now, not everyone struggles with this because the brain chemistry of each of us is different. But the cigarette is the most efficient delivery form of nicotine that exists. It gets nicotine to the brain basically in 5 heartbeats with a very sharp spike of nicotine, the likes of which you can't get any other way. Even giving it to yourself intravenously doesn't get it to your brain as fast as inhaling it. So every cigarette does that. And for some people, the brain chemistry is altered, and the brain receptors say, I want a cigarette under this circumstance, and that makes the cravings and urges very difficult.
And if you're
other people don't have any trouble at all. You know, everyone knows an Uncle Charlie. Uncle Charlie smoked 2 packs a day for 30 years, couldn't hold a job, was married 4 times, and one day woke up and said, I'm going to stop smoking, and he did.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, okay.
I love how that rolls off your tongue there, Doctor.
So everybody knows one of those people. And so for every smoker who struggles with this, they know Uncle Charlie, and they say, you know, if he could do that and I can't, then I must have some characterological flaw. But that's not the case at all. It's really a matter of brain chemistry and the neurobiology of this, and all smokers are not alike. So we treat this as a very serious medical problem. And we have a residential treatment program for people who struggle with this, and I just finished it last week, actually. And that's like if you went into treatment for other drugs of dependence, and we treat it that way because it is that severe for some people.
Sure, and the president was treating it seriously when he signed at his news conference the bill that is going to actually bring tobacco under the same regulatory regime as other substances. Here he is signing the bill.
Each day, 1,000 young people under the age of 18 become new regular daily smokers. And almost 90% of all smokers began at or before their 18th birthday. I know I was one of these teenagers. And so I know how difficult it can be to break this habit when it's been with you for a long time.
Do you think there's the chance, Dr. Hurt, that Barack Obama will have more influence as a smoker struggling with this in public than as someone who maybe doesn't have the experience in attempting to influence those young people?
Well, he certainly understands this, and I think that's really important. And I think that the federal government could do a lot more than we've ever done before, because every year, 450,000 Americans die of tobacco-caused diseases. That's the equivalent of 3 fully loaded 747s crashing daily, 365 days a year, with no survivors.
Well,
now, were that to happen today, 3 airliners go down, does anyone doubt that the federal government, through the FAA, would ground all 747s throughout the world until the problem was fixed?
Well,
and that's what happens on a regular basis. And so we need to come to grips with this because this is an epidemic that is of gargantuan proportions.
And the president is struggling with it quite publicly. Richard Hurt, thanks so much for that. He's the director of the Mayo Clinic Nicotine Dependent Center. He spoke with us from Rochester, Minnesota, about the president's admission that he is struggling with a powerful nicotine addiction. Another big story that we're following this morning is one that Yvonne Wenger, a reporter for the Post and Courier in Columbia, South Carolina, is familiar with. Yvonne, first of all, good morning.
Morning.
Where the heck is your governor, Yvonne?
Well, I guess at this point, maybe he's back in the capital city. We just don't know. The governor's staff continued to tell us as late as 8 p.m. last night that he had been hiking on the Appalachian Trail, but they didn't know where. And of course, our competitor, the state newspaper, ran into the governor in the Atlanta airport, and he did say that he had been in Buenos Aires, Argentina.
Now, it's your suspicion, I suspect, that there's something more going on here than Governor Mark Sanford having a geography problem in that he confuses Argentina with the Appalachian Trail.
Yeah, it's a few miles off. The thing that is pretty curious is that the governor's wife told our reporter at their beachfront home in Sullivan's Island outside of Charleston that she didn't know where her husband was and that he had been away for Father's Day. I think that elevated the story to a different level, and people really started becoming curious about, you know, really what the heck is going on.
Well, I mean, is there a constitutional question here? Does the state constitution in South Carolina permit the governor to leave the country without telling anyone?
There is some constitutional questions that have arisen about the transfer of power and when exactly, you know, that transfer would kick in. The lieutenant governor is able to act in the governor's position if an emergency arises, but before the governor left, he never communicated with our lieutenant governor. So there's some talk from top legislative officials that they're going to look at changing some constitutional provisions, and one other proposal is to keep make sure that the governor's security detail has to stay with him at all times.
Yvonne, you know, I'm speaking to you from New York City, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I know you're, you know, a solid reporter for the Post and Courier, but we are familiar here in New York with kind of governor shock. You know what I mean? Elliot Spitzer, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, there are no details as to why Governor Mark Sanford might have gone to Argentina, but is there any sort of rumor mill right now?
There are a lot of different rumors out there. Nothing that our paper has been able to confirm. I mean, people, I'm sure you can imagine all of the rumors that are out there.
You know I can imagine it. I live in the state from the Elliot Spitzer state. Of course, I can imagine everything. But is there any even domain of what? I mean, is it a business proposition? Is it he just wanted to get away? I mean, why would he even want to go hiking?
Well, the governor is, first off, very outdoorsy, and he's very fit. He goes running, and he said during many press conferences that he, you know, he likes to get away from his security detail whenever possible for a good run in the morning. And, I mean, he told the state newspaper reporter that he was in Argentina alone. And, you know, I don't have any inside information, but according to their story, when he arrived at the airport, they didn't make mention of anybody with him.
Mm. Well, according to some of the quotes that you referred to there, he described Buenos Aires as a great city. He claimed that he wanted to do something exotic. He was recharging after a tough legislative session. How long was he actually out of pocket? And just give us a sense of the beginning, middle, and end of this story.
Yeah. I talked to a state senator who's very critical of the governor on Monday, and he said that he had gotten wind that the governor was out of town on, you know, some mysterious terms, and he had called and confirmed that with the state law enforcement division director on Saturday night that they were indeed looking for the governor. The governor's staff then did say that the governor, you know, left for a trip on Thursday night, and you know, there wasn't really any reason to wonder where the governor was. They don't print a public schedule for him.
But still, it's pretty darn mysterious. 5 days out of pocket. I can hear that your phone is ringing. You're getting a call. I can imagine every reporter in the state is getting calls this morning. Yvonne Wenger, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Yvonne Wenger, reporter for the Post and Courier in Columbia, South Carolina, reporting on the whereabouts, the mysterious trip to Buenos Aires, Argentina, of Governor Mark Sanford.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. John Hockenberry here. A long, hot summer of issues and debates for President Obama. What's on the soundtrack to help him cool off?
This is Spike the Bus Driver from Webster, Massachusetts, and I think the song Doctor Doctor by Thompson Twins should be on that soundtrack for Mr. Obama.
I love that. Our listener finds a healthcare themed song there, although I didn't realize it when I was a Thompson Twins fan. Oh, many, many years ago. What's your suggestion at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email, mytake@thetakeaway.org. So joining us now is Jeff Beresford Howe, The Takeaway's sports contributor and one-man tailgate party, who we haven't spoken to in a while, but we were dying to hear his reaction to what Major League Baseball players found out this week. They're losing an icon, not A-Rod, it's not Sammy Sosa, it's not an A-list player at all, but Donald Fehr, the head of the Major League Players Union, who it's probably fair to say a lot of fans think of as the Darth Vader of baseball. Jeff Beresford Howe, what do you think of Donald Fehr?
Well, Don Fehr took a union that was struggling to continue to exist, and during his 26 years, he ended up running Major League Baseball. He, more than any other union leader in the United States, now runs his industry, and players are naturally very grateful to him for it.
Now, of course, players have benefited to an extraordinary degree, but are working people in America to take any sort of solace from the fact that here's a union leader who actually has taken control of his industry and done a heck of a job for the workers?
No, absolutely not. Don Fehr's concept of a union is unique among all unions in the United States. He runs a union that benefits only the very highest earners in his union. The vast majority of professional baseball players never see any of the huge income that we've come to associate with Major League Baseball. It's a union which is, you know, a lot of ways more like a guild than a union. It operates to protect that top 1% of earners and leaves everybody else behind.
Well, let's take a look at his legacy and try to tick it off for us. You've mentioned the salaries that have gone through the roof under his tenure. What else happened in the time that he's been head of the players' union?
The most important thing is that he's acted as a check on Bud Selig, who is there's no other way to put it. He's a chucklehead. He's one of the worst administrators in any industry in the United States. And every time Bud Selig comes up with some crazy idea, Don Fehr has been there to say no. Can't do that.
Well, that's actually a positive. And of course, Bud Selig is the Major League Baseball commissioner.
Yes. In name, although, of course, now at this point, Don Fehr has vastly more power than Selig actually does.
Right. There were how many strikes during Donald Fehr's tenure?
You know, in all the confusion, I lost track. 5 or 6, I guess.
Wow. And I have 2 by my count here. What about the steroid controversy? I mean, that happened on his watch.
It happened on his watch, and he's taken a huge amount of criticism for it. Bob Costas called him 100% wrong the other day. The truth is that Don Fehr's stand on steroids came out of the drug scandals of the 80s when Major League Baseball owners tried to use drug testing and investigatory commissions to force players to rat out each other and get out from under long-term contracts that they were committed to. It was a shameful and cynical use of the war on drugs, and that is what informed FEAR's decision to back away from drug testing. Now, he probably stayed away from drug testing and a recognition that steroids are a different issue than cocaine and marijuana use for too long, but the real responsibility for the lack of testing in baseball isn't Don Fear's. It's the owners and their attitude towards drugs in the 80s.
But here is Don Fear expressing some contrition in front of Congress in January of last year.
We cannot change, but we can learn from the past. Baseball's problem with performance-enhancing substances was bigger than I realized. We understood that a number of years ago when we began the testing programs. In retrospect, action should have been taken and probably could have been taken sooner.
Jeff Beresford, Howe, I wonder if Donald Fear has any regrets about the informal tests that the union took that resulted ultimately in A-Rod being exposed for having tested positive for a controlled substance.
Well, that's a really good question. I mean, he says he's using it as a convenient point now to say this is the point at which we knew it was serious. And the advantage of that from his point of view is that the union then began to move off its anti-testing perspective and admit the possibility of testing. It's inconceivable to everybody around baseball that Fear didn't know about it before then and just chose to not deal with the owners and open up the issue of drug testing again.
So who is going to replace Donald Fear as we think about a transition and a sort of a next act here?
Mike Weiner, who's been a lawyer for the Players Association for the last few years, he is, I guess, the George H.W. Bush to Fear's Ronald Reagan. He didn't go through the same kind of trial by fire that Fear did. He's generally considered kinder and gentler and more likely to agree with owners in ways to make the sport a little less confrontational in its labor negotiations.
Finally, if some constituency of players in Major League Baseball was going to demand a shift in emphasis or a change of course in the players' union, who would that be?
Two groups. Latin players who have been virtually ignored by the sport. They have special needs and special circumstances different from American players, and it's the union has essentially ignored those special needs. And the other group is the vast majority of professional players who never make Major League Baseball or barely make Major League Baseball, who are limited in their both compensation and training by the way this current system works.
Many,
and the union is acceded to.
Well, they're many in numbers, but their voice is small here. Jeff Beresford Howe, the Takeaway sports contributor and one-man tailgate party, talking about the Darth Vader of baseball, by some accounts, Donald Fear, retiring as head of the players' union. Thanks, Jeff.
You're welcome.
More about baseball from Jeff Beresford Howe on our website at thetakeaway.org. There's a blog post from Jeff on baseball needing a cleanup. Femi Okay has our headlines.
It's almost 29 minutes past the hour. In just a couple of minutes, Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius is due on Capitol Hill. She is scheduled to testify before a House Committee on Healthcare. Federal investigators are going to test the Washington subway's automated system that is meant to prevent train crashes, like the one that happened on Monday. The train was under the system's automatic control at the time of the crash. South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford told a state newspaper that he was in Argentina during his unexplained five-day absence and not hiking along the Appalachian Trail, as his office had previously stated.
Yes, look at his case. He was in Argentina for 5 days.
He wasn't in South Carolina. He was in South America.
He's in Argentina, yeah.
Duh.
It's like, what's the problem?
And that's your news.
Thank you for me.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. Our focus on Iran now. Earlier this morning, we were told by the former head of the BBC Persian service that the demonstrations in Iran, the pictures of which we have seen all week long and over the weekend, are actually continuing on the rooftops of Tehran. The BBC received this email from the streets of Tehran today. It's from a listener named Mazyar Irani in Tehran. Tehran is strangely quiet, the email says. Very little traffic on the streets. People are anxiously waiting. Thursday is expected to be a day of mourning. People will try gathering in all major squares and intersections. He won't be there to report it, but he's certainly following it closely. John Lyne, Tehran correspondent for our partner, the BBC, is joining us from London. Good morning, John.
Yeah, good morning.
The fact that we're speaking with you from London is an indication of the tensions and the difficulties of covering this story. But first of all, what do you make of what's going on in the government right now? It seems to me that at the very least, there's been an upheaval in the civilian government versus the sort of clerical authorities inside Iran.
Well, yes. I mean, look, President Ahmadinejad and Ayatollah Khamenei together really have taken a grip on the government machine, but it's a very divided establishment. Mr. Ahmadinejad has made many enemies, even within the ruling circles, there's no doubt about that. The clerics never like him, and they're even a bit sceptical about the leader himself. I'm wondering how the Revolutionary Guards are going to play this. They are very loyal to the Supreme Leader, but even some of them, I would think, must have their doubts about what's going on. And then, of course, there's the Parliament, which again is conservative, but in no ways loyal to Mr. Ahmadinejad. And they've got to approve his new cabinet, which comes up in a month or two. So there's quite a lot of politicking to go on within the system. And then, of course, there's the biggest question, which is former President Rafsanjani, who's been the biggest opponent of Mr. Ahmadinejad and even to an extent the leader. And he has a lot of levers under his control. In theory, he could even bring up the issue of dismissing the Supreme Leader, although that would be a huge, huge step to take. But so there's quite a lot of stuff to go on within the establishment, let alone, of course, what we are seeing or might see on the streets.
Well, I want to use you to get a bit of a civics lesson here on the way Iranian government works. Now, when you say that former President Rafsanjani, he's actually president twice down through history since 1979, he can actually call for the Supreme Leader's replacement or dismissal. Is that because he's on a committee that has that authority in theory?
Yeah, it's it makes the U.S. Constitution seem positively simple. Basically, there are several of these bodies with different functions, and the one that he's chairman of is called the Assembly of Experts. And it's a body entirely made up of clerics, and their job is to appoint, to review the performance of the Supreme Leader, and in theory to dismiss him. In practice, the Supreme Leader, they've never even, I don't think, reviewed the performance, let alone dismissed one. But they could, I think his task, I mean, he's obviously really struck out in opposition to Ahmadinejad and, for that matter, the leader. So former President Rafsanjani could assemble this body, who are, you know, sympathetic to him. They recently reappointed him with a big majority. And he could say to them, look, the way the Supreme Leader is acting is not in your interest. It's threatening your own position as cleric, some of whom, it is often rumoured, have made a bit of money out of the system. And it's threatening the Islamic Republic. So he could come to him with that kind of plea, but he'd have to play it pretty carefully. I mean, he's a very canny operator, and there's no suggestion that he has done this yet, but he certainly has been round in the city of Qom, the clerical capital, currying support from Ayatollahs, and he's even reportedly been speaking to Grand Ayatollah Sistani. As you know, he's a key figure in Iraq, but nevertheless, he's actually, in the Iranian system, he outranks most of the Grand Ayatollahs there, so he'd be a key friend to have on board as well. So
Sistani's credibility comes from his custodianship of the holy places in Iraq, which of course are a big focus of Shiites in Iran, and we shouldn't forget that Rafsanjani is himself, if I'm not mistaken, an Ayatollah, right?
That's right, he's an Ayatollah, he's an Ayatollah of about the same seniority as Ayatollah Khamenei. I mean, Ayatollah Khamenei, when he became Supreme Leader, was actually a Hujjatul Islam, which is the next rank down. He wasn't even a full Ayatollah. And very rapidly, and somewhat against due proper procedure, according to some people, he was promoted to full Ayatollah. And even now, sometimes in the Iranian official media, he's referred to as Ayatollah Buzurg, Grand Ayatollah, even though he's not officially Grand Ayatollah.
you know, we should say go to our website and we'll have all of this fully explained for you. But it would take weeks for us to do that. So I wouldn't encourage people to actually do that. But John Line, it does appear at the very least that grabbing of the reins of power by Ahmadinejad and Khamenei, the supreme leader, means that the election result isn't going to change. But I'm wondering if there is any impetus on the part of Ahmadinejad to offer some concessionary reforms to quiet things down, and what form might that take?
Quite the opposite. Mr. Ahmadinejad is not somebody known as a conciliator or a compromiser. But the bizarre thing in this situation is that it's almost as if he swapped roles with the supreme leader. Just watching again today, you had the supreme leader coming out, getting very directly involved in politics, telling people to behave themselves and saying that the full force of the law will come down on them, while President Ahmadinejad is serenely meeting a delegation from Belarus, not saying anything at all publicly. And he seems in a kind of way to have this strange authority over the supreme leader in a bizarre way. It's a most peculiar turn of events, because by most accounts, if, as most people in Iran think, Mr. Mousavi had won the election and had become president, he would have been absolutely no threat to the system whatsoever. In many ways, his presence as president might have even maintained the Islamic Republic more safely than Mr. Ahmadinejad.
Well, as you suggest, perhaps the takeaway there is that the fates politically of Ahmadinejad and Supreme Leader Khamenei are inextricably entwined as we go forward here. John Line, Tehran correspondent for our partner, the BBC, joining us from London. Thank you, John.
Thank you.
And Femi Okeh has some headlines now.
At 21 minutes to the top of the hour, the U.S. will send a new ambassador to Syria, according to senior administration officials. This comes after a four-year break without one, and nobody has been chosen for the post yet. A scheduled meeting between the Middle East envoy George Mitchell and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has been cancelled. An Israeli newspaper says that the U.S. cancelled it in response to Israel's refusal to stop all settlement construction. But Netanyahu's aide says that he cancelled the meeting and wanted Mitchell to meet with Israeli Defense Minister Ehud Barak first. Today, the Pentagon launches Cybercom. It's a new group commanding all forces defending Pentagon networks and attacking enemy systems. The Obama administration is increasingly turning its attention to digital security. Just a few weeks ago, the president rolled out a plan for a separate civilian cybersecurity office run out of the White House. Turning to business now, a doctor at a Memphis hospital says that the Apple founder Steve Jobs received a liver transplant there and that he is recovering well. Apple has not confirmed that the transplant took place, only that Jobs will return to work by the end of June. Whenever Jobs seems to be ill, the Apple shares tend to go down. So the two are connected, and Apple is very careful about saying anything about Jobs and his health.
Does he call it an eye liver? His new liver?
Let's hope
we're
it's
happy
a,
that he's
let's
healthy.
Let's just hope it's just a healthy, good,
exactly.
working
Thank
liver.
You, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. And the president got some momentum on healthcare yesterday at his news conference. He talked about it a lot, but among those paying very close attention as Congress and the White House tackle healthcare reform, it's not simply analysts and lawmakers, but the people likely to be affected by any healthcare reform, and that would include Precious Lowe, a self-insured Atlanta resident. Good morning, Precious.
Good morning.
How do you rate what's been going on? President Obama, of course, talked about health care reform. There was a price tag issued by the Congressional Budget Office last week. We even talked to Senator Grassley this morning about some of the discussions that are going on in Washington. What's your headline?
Well, from my standpoint as a regular worker, I appreciate the try. I appreciate them at least looking into it because it definitely is needed. From my standpoint, I do... currently work. Unfortunately, my employer does not provide me with health insurance. So therefore, I've had to go out and price what I can afford. And to be honest, what I can afford really doesn't cover much. So I do need some assistance with that. So it would actually be very helpful if our government could assist with that and provide those health insurance for those who unfortunately are not working and for those who are working and unfortunately do not have health insurance through their employer.
How much roughly are you paying out of pocket, and what sort of coverage, you say it's insufficient, are you getting?
Yeah. Well, it's, I'm not paying much out of pocket. It's basic. It is actually $29 a month.
That's
not bad. However, it's a supplemental health insurance. And what it is, of course, is you pay up front first, then you have to put in your claims to get a certain amount depending on where you go, if it's in network, outside of network, and depending on what you get done.
So I gotta figure, Precious, that you're working for some kind of fly-by-night small business there in Atlanta that can't afford to cover its employees, right?
Well, yeah, you would think so, but unfortunately, it's not exactly that way. I actually am a clerk with the U.S. Census Bureau here in Atlanta at the regional office.
So you work for the federal government?
That's correct.
And you have to buy your own insurance?
Unfortunately, yeah. What it is you have to be there at a certain amount of time before they can offer you health insurance.
And these are the kinds of predicaments that all workers are in. And the federal government likes to say it has the best health care plan of any employer in the country. That's outrageous.
Yeah, I get it a lot. To be honest, I was a little surprised. But the way the economy is going, we all need jobs. And, you know, they offered it. And I'm grateful for the job, but that was really kind of I really didn't understand the decision behind that one, unless they just want to make sure you're going to stick with them and work. But the time that you have to be there in order to get the health insurance is a year and a day. Generally, with other companies, big and small, from some I've heard, it's about a month.
Right.
Well, before you can get into the program.
Well, I we're getting a good sense of your predicament. We only have a few more seconds, but is it fair to say that the thing you're most interested in, Precious Lowe, self-insured Atlanta resident, is the subsidy part of the health care reform, that you'd be assisted in purchasing your own health care plan?
That's correct, yes. That it's affordable, that it's a decent amount of coverage, and that when they say they want to make it affordable for all, let's do that. Can you really...
Well said, Precious Lowe, self-insured Atlanta resident. Thanks for joining us. Have a great
day.
Thank you.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, soliciting opinions about schools that offer students cash rewards for improved grades and attendance records. Is it ethical? Is it bribery? Viewpoints now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. Coming up, a conversation with Elizabeth Warren, chair of the Congressional Oversight Panel monitoring the financial bailout, and also the woman who may have inspired the centerpiece of Barack Obama's regulatory scheme for the new oversight of the entire financial system. But all this morning, we're also talking with you about how to give President Obama some relief this summer, from Iran to health care to the Supreme Court to continuing to try to quit smoking. It's going to be a long, hot summer for our commander-in-chief. What's on the soundtrack to help cool him off?
Hello, this is Gration from Gig Harbor, Washington. I think President Obama's playlist song should be...
Wanna go? Go cool!
Keep it cool, boy. The soundtrack from The West Side Story.
Boy, boy, crazy boy. Get cool, boy. Got a rocket in your pocket.
Nice. When you're a jet all the way. What's your song for the long, hot summer at 877-8-MY-TAKE? Or you can send an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. Get cool, Femi, okay, with the headlines.
Thanks. So just gone 12 minutes past the hour. To the hour, sorry. Didn't mean to make you late there. The wife of Iran's top opposition presidential candidate, Mir Hussein Mousavi, says that Iran is now under martial law. Her new statement on his website refers to the government crackdown on protesters. Mousavi's website also says that there is a protest planned today, but because of the strict government restrictions on the press, it's not confirmed if any demonstration is actually taking place. An investigation by our partner, the BBC, into the treatment of prisoners at the US-run Bagram Detention Center in Afghanistan has uncovered allegations of physical and emotional abuse. Here's a clip from two former Bagram inmates that the BBC talked to.
They put a pistol in my ear. They said I had to speak or be shot.
They put guns to your head and threatened you with death. They played very loud music and put medicine in our drinks to prevent us from sleeping while they interrogated us.
The Pentagon denies the accusations of abuse. It says that the Defense Department policy is to treat detainees humanely. The chief financial regulator on the Caribbean island of Antigua has been dismissed following charges that he colluded in a massive fraud with the American financier Alan Stanford. The Antigua cabinet says that it will investigate of other offshore companies, and Antigua's Attorney General Justin Simon has been defending the island's financial reputation.
It is not the system that was at fault, but it is basically a runaway staff member that has actually behaved in a manner which was inimical to the commission.
Leroy King was indicted last week in the US, accused of helping Alan Stanford conduct a $7 billion fraud. Alan Stanford has denied any wrongdoing. Some strong economic numbers out this morning. Big ticket manufacturing orders, or so-called durable goods, are up for a second straight month. The latest jump is 1.8%, and that was a lot better than forecasters expected. And finally, South Carolina Republican Governor Mark Sanford continues to be a man of mystery. He tells his local state paper that he was in Argentina not hiking the Appalachian Trail, as his aide said earlier. South Carolina Democratic State Senate leader John Land isn't impressed with the governor's behavior.
Strange, different, erratic, and kind of irrational.
He's talking about Argentina there?
No, he's talking about Governor Mark Sanford, who's now safely back home after hiking the Appalachian Trail via South America.
Disappearing for 5 days.
Yes.
That is truly a bizarre story. Thank you, Femi.
You're very welcome.
So Barack Obama, in addition to sort of suggesting that he does have a long, hot summer ahead of him, spoke yesterday about a variety of consumer issues, particularly health care. And yesterday, the president spoke to consumers on financial issues as well, those concerned about the financial meltdown and the global economic crisis.
Whether it's how credit cards are handled, how annuities are dealt with, there's a whole bunch of financial transactions out there where consumers are not protected the way they should. And that's why we said we're going to put forward a consumer financial protection agency whose only job it is to focus on those issues.
Call it the birth of an acronym, the Consumer Financial Protection Agency, the CFPA. Congress is dealing with it as the centerpiece of the president's new regulatory scheme to prevent what happened in the credit markets that resulted and continued the financial crisis that we talk about almost every day on this program. But the woman who is perhaps the architect or the inspiration for this Consumer Financial Protection Agency joins us now. Elizabeth Warren is the chairwoman of the Congressional Oversight Panel on the TARP, which is another acronym, the Troubled Asset Relief Program. She's also the Leo Gottlieb Professor of Law at Harvard and joins us from the Senate building in Washington, D.C. Elizabeth, is it fair to say that really throughout your career you have argued for a consumer financial protection agency, and one way or another you've managed to get it to be the financial centerpiece of the president's new regulatory strategy?
Well, the first half of that, sure, right. I've been arguing for this in one form or another, I think, for most of my professional career. But it's the president who made the decision about what's the centerpiece of his proposals.
Well, you know, congratulations to you for being so persuasive. I guess the question is, can you regulate financial products in the same way that, say, the FDA regulates food and drugs, or other agencies like the FAA regulates how safety procedures are followed with the airlines?
Sure. And the point is really, in many ways, basically the same. You know, we can pick a product. One of my favorites to talk about is to think about how toasters are regulated. They're regulated for the kinds of things that consumers can't see. So I don't know about you, but I wouldn't know how to read a wiring diagram to tell whether or not there's adequate insulation, or whether they use substandard wiring, or whether or not they use the cheap safety switches that won't shut off and my toaster will burst into flames. in effect, we're kind of in the same position right now with a lot of our credit products. Again, I don't know about you, but I can't read my 30-page credit card agreement. It's loaded with language that doesn't make any sense. Frankly, it's too darn long. If I wanted to compare four credit card contracts, I'd have more than 100 pages of fine print I'd have to wade through, making it almost impossible to tell overall which is the cheapest card, which is the riskiest card, how much those free gifts are really costing me. So what this agency is about saying, look, if you can't explain it to the consumer, then you shouldn't be doing it. You need simple, straightforward, some plain vanilla products that people can understand and compare.
Well, it seems like there's two parts to this regulatory scheme. And some have said that the simplification, the kind of getting rid of the fine print and making it more understandable, while really, really important, is also something of the low-hanging fruit here. And that the real question, the harder question, is how do you really protect people when risk is so hard to determine in the financial environment? You kind of don't know what your bank is doing in China or Brazil, and it's hard for you to know the safety of your assets if the institution that you're getting your credit card from is off doing some sort of shenanigans someplace where you aren't even watching.
Oh, fair enough point on that. And I should point out the plan here is really that those two operations are completely separated. The Consumer Financial Protection Agency, I hate to say it, it really is about the low-hanging fruit. Or another way to say it is about the really awful stuff that's right there in front of us and we can fix.
All right, but can I just interrupt you there for a second? You said you want to separate these two. That would seem to suggest we're going back to a Glass-Steagall kind of a model.
No. Different direction in terms of the separation with Glass-Steagall. What I meant was there will still be what are called prudential regulators of the financial institutions. These are the ones who are always watching the financial institutions for safety and soundness. So, you know, if they're off investing in copper mines in Argentina, that might be kind of a high-risk investment. That's the sort of thing that the bank oversight agencies are supposed to look at. Currently, of course, that's the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, the OCC, and the OTS, Office of Thrift Supervision, under the administration's plan. Those two are merged together, and we would have a single federal bank regulator. But they're looking at the riskiness of general business practices by the bank. This one is about the products that they sell to consumers like you and me.
Well, at the very least, as things get understandable, managing risks is going to involve a lot of heads getting around a very big table. Elizabeth Warren, fortunately, is one of those. She chairs the Congressional Oversight Panel, which monitors the financial bailout. She's also a professor of law at Harvard. Thanks so much for joining us. And from the financial crisis, Iran, to healthcare, to the Supreme Court, it's a long, hot summer for President Obama. Cool down, won't you?
Hi, this is Rick from Michigan. My suggestion for a song is Smoke Gets in Your Eyes.
Smoke gets in your eyes.
Or maybe Wipe Out.
Wipe Out.
What's on your song for your playlist for a long, hot summer? You can put it at our website, thetakeaway.org. You can share what other listeners are saying. And there's a regime change in baseball. Jeff Beresford Howe has a blog post you can find on the website. Podcast anything if you missed it. We're always on at The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry, but I'm not always on the air. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. See ya.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.